morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'll be talking with Don Howard, professor and director of the graduate program in History of Philosophy of Science at the University of Notre Dame. And our topic is going to be contemporary physics. Don, glad to have you on the show.
Well, Hugh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be able to participate.
Now, to get us going, when we think about it, contemporary physics, it really is identified by two major branches or developments, relativity physics and quantum physics. Before we begin to talk a little bit more about the relationship between them, what you see for the future, it might be helpful if you would briefly describe for the listener what you take to be the sort of central themes of relativity physics and quantum mechanics, given the time constraints, obviously.
Surely. Well, it's certainly the case that the physics of the 20th century has been dominated by relativity theory and the quantum theory. As a first approximation to describing the theories and their relations, it's perhaps helpful to think of quantum mechanics and its descendant theory, quantum field theory, as being our current best theory of the micro-realm. It's the theory that we employ to understand atomic structure, radioactive decay, all of the mysterious events of the quantum micro-world. It's the framework theory within which we understand the behavior of quarks and so forth. By contrast, it's helpful to think of relativity theory as the our best current theory of the macro-world. Among other things, the relativity theory is the framework that we use for understanding the large-scale structure of the universe. Hence, it's the framework within which modern relativistic cosmology is done. Both of these theories date back to the early 20th century. Quantum mechanics was born in 1900 out of the efforts of Max Planck to understand the mysteries of so-called black-body radiation. And 5 years later, in 1905, Einstein made an essential advance in our understanding of quantum theory in a famous paper he wrote on the photoelectric effect. The theory was brought into more or less its modern formulation in the 1920s through the work of people like Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg and Erwin Schrödinger. And then, starting in the 1930s, we saw the development of quantum field theory, a process that then really picked up momentum after the Second World War with the work of people like Julian Schwinger and Feynman and Tominaga and others. Relativity theory also goes back to the beginning of the 20th century. It was also in 1905, and indeed in the same same volume of the journal Annalen der Physik, that Einstein published his first paper on special relativity. It was further refined with Einstein's introduction of the general principle of relativity in 1915, and that's an important generalization of the theory because that's the point where it also came to be understood that the major revision in our understanding of the nature of space and time that comes with relativity theory would also, somewhat surprisingly, entail a theory of gravitation. Yet another way of understanding what the two theories do and a way of starting to talk about the relationship between them is indeed to think of general relativity as the framework within which we understand the nature of gravity, one of the four fundamental forces in nature, and quantum mechanics provides, and quantum field theory provides, the framework within which we understand the other three fundamental forces in nature, the electromagnetic force and the strong and weak nuclear forces.
Okay, I mean, you mentioned the relationship between them. The fact that we talk of these as two separate fields within physics suggests that we've not quite worked out how they hang together. Is that true?
Well, indeed, that is true. And the question of how, if at all, to unify quantum mechanics and relativity theory is the big question still on the agenda of fundamental physics in the late 20th century. That there should be some relationship between quantum mechanics and relativity theory seems obvious because, after all, if you consider the kind of quantum processes that the quantum theory describes, think of the radioactive decay of an atom, we think, perhaps naively, that these events take place in space and time. And so we would think, again, perhaps naively, that the dramatically revised understanding of the nature of space and time that we get with Einstein, such as, for example, general relativity's prediction of the curvature of space and time, we would think that that should affect our understanding of quantum processes taking place in space and time. So anyway, one would think that there should be a clear relationship between them, but no one's been able to establish what that relationship is, even at the end of the 20th century, nearly 100 years after the introduction of these two theories. And the effort to try to find a way to bring them together in some broader, unified perspective, as mentioned, one of the major questions on the forefront of contemporary research in fundamental physics.
Could you at least say something about why it seems to be difficult to unify them? I mean, if you say it seems likely that we ought to be able to unify them, physicists have certainly been playing around with these theories now for almost 100 years. What's the bar to unifying them?
Well, part of the puzzle is figuring out what the bar to unification is. On the face of it, the obstacles to unification start with the fact that the two theories employ totally different mathematical formalisms with totally different mathematical tools, for the most part, very different sets of fundamental physical concepts. When one asks at a finer level of description where the obstacles are to be found, one begins to reflect on facts such as this. As mentioned, general relativity entails that in most regions of the universe, space and time is curved by the presence of matter and energy. The quantum theory, when it describes quantum processes, is surely describing events that involve material bodies possessed of energy in various forms, and so we're talking about events in a region of the universe where there is non-negligible mass and energy. So again, one would think that that should induce curvature in space-time of the kind that Einstein predicted in general relativity. And yet, curiously, the way we do quantum mechanics and quantum field theory is with the assumption of what we call a flat space-time background. Partly we do this because it's mathematically much, much harder to try to figure out how to do quantum field theory in curved space-time. But whatever the reasons, it nevertheless is the case, therefore, that our mathematics is pushing us in a direction away from an easy unification of the two formalisms.
Before we talk a little bit more about the prospects for unification, the direction you think we might want to go,
is it made these thinkers much more acutely sensitive to fundamental conceptual questions. Here again, you see their papers filled with ruminations about the fundamental nature of space and time and matter and energy. And going along with that conceptual questions was another distinctive
Maxwellian electrodynamics. Maybe you could say a little bit about what the problems were.
Physical systems. Let's call that assumption the assumption of spatiotemporal separability. The modern theory of relativity, general relativity, inherited that assumption about the mutual independence. In fact, Einstein believed that this assumption was virtually an a priori necessary condition for the very possibility of an adequate physical theory. And he thought that one of the virtues of general relativity was that it gave perhaps the most radical expression to this assumption of spatiotemporal virtue of its treating, in effect, every point of space-time itself as a separable physical system. Many people have had the intuition that Winston, by contrast, previously disparate physical theories, one thereby gains a much deeper insight into what underlies the phenomena described by these disparate theories. And it's certainly the case that when you look at historical examples of successful unifications, that those unifications will frequently bring with them predictions about heretofore undiscovered phenomena, and that seems to be a clue that indeed unification brings with it a deeper understanding of nature. On the other hand, history is littered with examples of failed attempts at unification, and that's should lead us to think about the experience of the physics community at the end of the 19th century, because in many respects there's a striking similarity between the situation then and the situation now. The situations are similar in that both at the end of the 19th century and here at the end of the 20th century, the physics community is filled with optimism about our perhaps finally being on the threshold of an ultimate unification of all of physical theory. Thus, here at the end of the 20th century, you see books appearing like Weinberg's The Final Theory. A Final Theory. You saw titles like that appearing at the end of the 19th century as well. Now, here we think at the end of the 20th century that we're on the verge of unifying relativity theory and quantum mechanics. At the end of the 19th century, people thought that they were on the verge of unifying Newtonian mechanics and Maxwellian electrodynamics. That attempt at unification failed, and the reasons for the failure are perhaps instructive for our hopes for unification at the end of the at the end of the 20th century. Everyone at the end of the 19th century realized that there were a few annoying little problems that were standing in the way of a successful unification. Problems such as the problem of anomalous specific heats, just to mention one, or the problem of the spectrum of black body radiation, to mention another one. But the attitude was that most of these problems were just anomalies, that explaining them in the framework of a unified physical theory would really just be a matter of mopping up and fixing up some details of our understanding of the universe. In fact, it turned out that these seemingly minor problems contained within them the seeds of the great revolutions in physics in the 20th century, both the quantum revolution and the relativity revolution. That experience of the physics community at the end of the 19th century might induce a little caution here at the end of the 20th century, when the air is filled with admittedly very exciting programs that hold out the prospect of unification of quantum mechanics and relativity, string theory being one of many such examples, and perhaps the most exciting example on the table today. But just as at the end of the 19th century, there are some troubling little problems that seem to pose obstacles to unification. The attitude seems to be that most of these are problems that will eventually yield to a fairly easy solution, and perhaps they will. On the other hand, maybe we find ourselves in the same situation we were in at the end of the 19th century. Maybe these few little problems that are there on the frontiers of physics, maybe they again contain within them the seeds of a massive revolution in our understanding of physical theory. One can't predict the future course of physical theory, but the experience at the end of the 19th century should perhaps induce a little bit of caution, might lead people to want to modulate ever so slightly their perhaps overbold hopes that we stand on the verge of finally getting a single theory of everything.
In the second half of the show, I want to come back and talk about the beginnings. You talked about the problems leading to the revolutions in the creation of relativity theory and quantum theory. Before I do, though, I'd like to pause briefly for the benefit of anyone who's tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest this morning is Don Howard, professor and director of the graduate program in the History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Notre Dame, and our topic is contemporary physics. Could you say a little bit about the beginnings of those revolutions and what in the beginnings might give us some insight about how to think about the potential unification currently?
Well, I think one of the salient facts about the revolutions of the early 20th century has to do with the way physics was being done at the turn of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. From my point of view, one of the most striking features of the way physics was being done at that time, by contrast with the way I think we do physics today, is that one found what I would like to describe as a more philosophical approach to doing physics. You see this in the work of virtually all of the major players in physics at the turn of the century: Max Planck, Albert Einstein, Werner Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger, Wolfgang Pauli. All of these individuals were very well trained in philosophy, reading and thinking about philosophy was an important part of their intellectual lives. It was quite a common experience, for example, for every gymnasium student and every university student in German-speaking Europe at the end of the 19th century to have read Kant, for example. And I think that this philosophical training and the philosophical habit of thought that I see in evidence in the work of these individuals made a difference in the way they did physics. What kind of a difference? Well, I think it made a difference in a couple of areas. For one thing, one sees in the writings of these individuals a much greater sensitivity to questions about the methodology of the sciences than I think one finds in the work of contemporary physicists. They were always asking questions about what is the nature of a physical theory? What is the logical relationship between theory and observation and experiment? A second kind of difference that I think this philosophical habit of mind made is it made these thinkers much more acutely sensitive to fundamental conceptual questions. Here again, you see their papers filled with ruminations about the fundamental nature of space and time and matter and energy. And going along with that sensitivity to fundamental conceptual questions was another distinctive trait of this more philosophical way of doing physics, and that is a certain healthy skepticism about whether or not the received concepts, the conceptual framework of the physics of the previous generation, a healthy skepticism about whether those received concepts were going to be the proper concepts for a new physics. So they were always asking probing critical questions about whether or not the assumption, for example, the old Newtonian assumption that space and time were absolute, was really an empirically well-grounded assumption. They were asking questions about whether such an assumption could be maintained consistently with equally fundamental principles in other domains, like the conservation of energy or the relativity principle. So again, there are at least two or three notable facts about the way in which these thinkers did their physics that I think distinguishes the physics of that earlier generation from the physics of today. And I think this has implications for the way in which we think about unification at the end of the 20th century. I think that we stand a better chance of solving the problem of coming up with a unified understanding of nature if we can find a way to once again, to develop this more philosophical approach to doing physics.
How might it help specifically? Do you have any particular clues?
Well, one can point to certain problems that may or may not be part of the problem of unification, where the potential severity of the problems have perhaps been has not been appreciated as widely as it should. Perhaps for lack of this more philosophical habit of mind. The one that always comes first to my mind is what some people will call the problem of spatio-temporal separability. Let me try to describe in fairly simple terms what the issue is here. In classical physics, we always assumed that when two physical systems were located in different regions of space-time, that their being thus located in different regions of space-time was sufficient to make them genuinely independent physical systems. Let's call that assumption the assumption of spatio-temporal separability. The modern theory of relativity, general relativity, inherited that assumption about the mutual independence of physical systems. And in fact, Einstein believed that this assumption was virtually an a priori necessary condition for the very possibility of an adequate physical theory. And he thought that one of the virtues of general relativity was that it gave perhaps the most radical expression to this assumption of spatio-temporal separability by virtue of its treating, in effect, every point of space-time itself as a separable physical system. By contrast, one of the most striking features of the quantum theory is that at a very deep level, it seems to deny this assumption about spatiotemporal separability. Within the framework of the quantum theory, whenever you have two physical systems interacting, after the interaction, the proper way to represent the joint state of those previously interacting systems is in terms of what we call a wave function that cannot be expressed as any kind of logical product or sum of separate wave functions for the two separate systems. Thus, there's a sense in which two physical systems that live in different parts of space-time and hence classically would have been thought to be independent systems, there's a sense in which in quantum mechanics they lose crucial aspects of that separate identity, again, in the sense that the only way to get an accurate physical description of the future behavior of those previously interacting systems is to describe them by means of a joint state that can't be teased apart into a product of separate states. The term that we use in quantum mechanics to describe this feature, it's a charming term owed to Schrodinger, is to speak of these previously interacting systems now as being entangled with one another. Well, here's a deep conceptual problem. If the fundamental ontology of the quantum theory is one in which previously interacting systems lose their separate physical identities, and if, on the other hand, by contrast, the fundamental ontology of general relativity is one in which spatiotemporally separated systems still always maintain their separate identities, well, on the face of it, we seem to have a clear conceptual obstacle to ultimate unification here. It's not as though this kind of problem is totally ignored in physics of the late 20th century. Many people find the program of string theory to be attractive because it might be a way of trying to produce a unified theory of all of the four fundamental forces that incorporates this lesson about the entanglement of previously interacting systems. But the main point I'd make here is that here's a kind of a problem that isn't an experimental problem, or at least at first blush it's not an experimental problem or an observational problem. It's a problem that lies down at the most basic level of these two physical theories, the most basic conceptual apparatus that the two physical theories deploys. It's at that level that I think this more philosophical way of approaching fundamental physics could perhaps pay dividends, simply by drawing our attention to these fundamental features of the ontologies of our physical theories.
Okay, we've got about a little over five minutes left. Let me sort of ask a multi-part question and then let you run with it. One is maybe the language of ontology. You might want to say a little bit about what that is for the listener if they're not sure. Secondly, it might be interesting to speculate on why modern physics is less philosophical than it was at the beginning of this century. And lastly, to say a little bit about how you think string theory might resolve the problem or might lead to unification.
Okay, well, first, ontology. That's a philosopher's term. And it simply means the set of assumptions one makes about the fundamental constituents of the physical universe, the things that populate the universe and the way they relate to one another. So that's what we mean by ontology. Now the question about why we have a rather less philosophical physics at the end of the 20th century by comparison with the beginning of the 20th century. Partly it has to do with the different way in which physicists are trained in the end of the 20th century. I mentioned before the fact that it was a very common part of the experience of young physicists at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, to be expected to know a lot of philosophy, to read Kant. It's very interesting when you look at the transcript of Einstein's university work. One finds that all students in the faculty in which he was trained at the Swiss Federal Polytechnical Institute in Zurich, all of the physics students, were required to take courses in philosophy as a part of their physics education. Specifically, they were required to take a course called, in German, Theorie des wissenschaftlichen Denkens, which translates as the theory of scientific thought. It was a course in philosophy of science and methodology. That was very typical of the education of physicists at the beginning of the 20th century. It would be quite exceptional in the training of young physicists at the end of the 20th century. Not only is it unusual for young physicists to be expected to have a training in philosophy, the culture is so different now that a training in philosophy is often looked down upon as, at the very least, a distraction from one's training in physics. And in some cases, the attitude is that it just muddies the mind and makes one a poorer physicist. So there's a certain prejudice against a training in philosophy that one finds nowadays. One could point to other important differences, such as differences in the institutional structure of physics a century ago and physics today. Today, physics, for the most part, is done in the context of very large research groups, which were more or less unknown back at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. Theoretical physicists were more on their own, as it were, in an earlier era. So those are a couple of the features of the way physics is done today that might help to explain this somewhat less philosophical approach that I think one finds today.
Okay, and the last, and I've got about a little under 2 minutes here, to talk about what the string theory and how you think it might help either lead to unification or show us why unification won't work.
Well, the answer to that is that string theory very self-consciously starts off with an ontology, that is a set of assumptions about the fundamental things in the universe, that is very different in kind from the ontology of the physics of a previous generation. Perhaps the clearest way to indicate the difference is that, for the most part, we tended to think about physics in the past in terms of point particles. We would model an atom, we would model an electron, we would model a quark as a discrete entity localized in a small region of space-time, all of its matter and associated energy localized with it in that small region of space-time. More complicated structures would then be represented as assemblages of point particles of this kind. String theory, by contrast, postulates as the fundamental elements of its ontology spatially extended objects. That's the whole point of the string metaphor, so that they are not localized within one region of space-time, but by their very nature live over an extended region of space-time. Beyond that, string theory has built into it a picture of interactions that would model a lot of interactions, not in a classical way, say, for example, after the fashion of two billiard balls colliding with one another, but instead by way of two previously disparate strings merging into one larger string. So again, there's a fundamental departure from an older way of thinking about the fundamental furniture of the universe, that departure being that we are abandoning this picture of point particles in favor of an ontology, the fundamental units of which are themselves spatially extended objects.
Okay, I think that's a nice summary. Thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Well, thank you very much,
Hugh. I've been speaking today with Don Howard, professor and director of the graduate program in the History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Notre Dame. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.